Hello, welcome to the audio file for the Physics 100 lecture for February 16th, 2009. This audio file has an accompanying PDF file with the slides posted on the web, and you'll want to be referring to that as I go through the audio. Make yourself comfortable. I do feel like a complete idiot sitting in a empty hotel room talking to myself, but that's the nature of this. At any rate, it'll be hard for me to make it entertaining probably because I'm sitting here talking to myself. So for that, I apologize, but I did try to drink too much coffee to see if I could do that anyway. We'll see what happens. At any rate, if you can pull up the PDF file and let's look at page one, I will signify the page numbers by the numbers circled in light blue at the upper right-hand edge of each page. So at the end of class last time, we were talking about units of energy. There is a particular unit, the most widely used unit of energy, is the joule, which is a metric unit of energy, which is what you use if you use a system of energy with where you're measuring lengths in meters, mass in kilograms, and time in seconds. This is really good for normal types things, things in everyday life. If you want to measure the kinematics of a car, or the motion of a car, or a baseball, or a football, or something, this is a unit that is very convenient to use. In chemistry, for atomic processes, subatomic things, so high energy physics, lots of physics of very high energies or very small things. A typical unit that we use is called the electron volt, and the electron volt is really defined as the amount of energy that an electron is gains as it is accelerated in the electric field that you would find between the poles of a 1-volt battery. So you can see a little graphic at the bottom of page 1 that illustrates this. If I hooked a battery up to two little metal plates and measured the amount of energy for an electron that might move from the negative plate to the positive plate, it would actually gain an energy of 1 electron volt. This really isn't very much energy. But of course it's an extremely small thing, an electron. 1 electron volt corresponds to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules if you ever needed to convert. So let's go to page 2. 1 electron volt is actually a small amount of energy relative to what is commonly used in particle and nuclear physics. So very often we will talk about thousands of electron volts, millions of electron volts, billions, and thousands of billions of electron volts. So these are given by the abbreviations that I show in the middle of the top of page 2. So you have the electron volt, you have the thousands of electron volts in keV, MeV for millions, GeV for billions. G actually stands for giga, so it's giga electron volts, and T stands for tera electron volts, is thousands of billions of electron volts. And so you'll hear about processes and particles and everything with these types of energies. Now it's not just a unit of energy, actually, and partly why I'm wasting, well, hopefully not wasting time, but why I'm discussing it, is that if you recall, if you go in the middle of page 2 where I have the pink A in a circle, you recall the famous equation E equals mc squared. Well, imagine putting the energy of something in electron volts, then the mass of a particle could be measured in terms of electron volts over c squared, which is a little bit strange to imagine, but basically, you just pull the c squared. So it turns out that this is the unit of mass that particle and nuclear physicists use for various types of particles. So I could tell you the mass of an electron in kilograms, and it's some tiny number like 10 to the minus 31 or 29. I don't remember. I can look it up. But it's an extremely small and inconvenient to use number with a very big negative exponent. Whereas the mass of an electron in the units of electron volts over c squared is 0.511 million electron volts over c squared. So this is sort of the common way that physicists refer to the masses of particles. You have to be a little bit careful, because by the equation E equals mc squared, if you want to talk about mass, then you have to talk about energy divided by c squared. So if you want to properly talk about the mass of the electron, you have to give it as 0.511 MeV over c squared. But it is very common for physicists to inadvertently drop the c squared. So we, in the lingo, you will often hear electrons referred to as having a mass of 0.511 MeV, which is an energy unit. But that's just sort of a shortcut that they use. So generally in books, people are fairly careful about this, and you'll see mass is referred to as electron volts over c squared. But in conversation, in lecture, and whatever, you may find that somebody drops the c squared. And if they're talking about the mass of something, don't get hung up about it. Just remember that so many millions of electron volts corresponds to, in mass, in terms of mass, so many millions of electron volts divided by c squared. Any rate, so let's go to page 3. Now, one of the big themes that we have been discussing over the last several lectures is the strange aspect of light. We know from Maxwell's equations and the fact that mathematically one can describe light in terms of being a wave, and the fact that light exhibits all of the standard characteristics of every other wave that has ever been discovered by man, interference, diffraction, refraction, etc. We know that light is a wave. However, Planck and Einstein explained two physical phenomena that were known to exist that could not be explained by the wave picture of light by assuming that light exists in little packets. And in fact, those packets come with a very particular energy that depends on the frequency of the light, and E equals H nu. So H is a constant called Planck's constant, and nu is the frequency. What is amazing, or had to be really earth-shattering importance and amazing in 1905, Planck developed a theory, and within the context of that theory, people could go and make measurements of blackbody radiation and derive a value for Planck's constant that made the theory fit the data. Similarly, people could look at the photoelectric effect data and derive a value for Planck's constant that would make it fit the data. It is the fact that Planck's constant derived from each experiment was seen to be the same number really tells us that Planck's work or Einstein's work is not a fortuitous accident, that in fact they're telling us something fundamental about light. So nature simply says that light is a particle, and it is in the character of humans to want to see waves and particles be separate beasts, but apparently nature has no such hang-ups. So if we go to page four, as strange as it seems, light has both wave and particle properties. And you might say, well, if I can't imagine it having both wave and particle properties, and I'm trying to explain something, how do I know what kind of model to use for the light? The truth is, in science, you use whatever model really seems to work for what you need. So if you want to understand the photoelectric effect, it is the particle aspect of light that's important, and that's sort of the model you use. If you want to understand diffraction of light, the particle model doesn't really work, and the wave part of light you use, and the fact that humans have a difficult time sort of visualizing the two happening simultaneously is really our limitation. These packets of light in the early years were called quanta. Quanta, a quantum is, you know, meaning a small discrete thing. In 1926, a chemist named Gilbert Lewis at Berkeley coined the word photon for these quanta. And that name has stuck. Now, in fact, he had a very particular... He actually thought that these packets of light always maintained their integrity. So, for example, an atom would absorb a packet of light, but in absorbing it, that packet of light would basically be maintain its integrity within the atom until it was actually sent away. In fact, what we believe is that the quanta of light are absorbed and that energy turns into other things, and later on the atom may spit out another quantum of light. But light quanta can be created and destroyed in modern physics and the way we think about it. And Gilbert Lewis wasn't really thinking about it that way. So in a sense, the theory that that is behind the word photon, it was thrown out, but the word stuck. So in the middle of page 4, you see sort of a visualization of something, the way I think of a photon packet in a sense. It is particle-like in that it has a discrete energy and some confinement in terms of space. At the same time, it has wave-like characteristics. So if you want to visualize this packet as a wave, then you use V equals lambda nu. If you want to visualize it as a particle, you use E equals H nu. And light can do both. So sometimes people call this light wavicles. So instead of a particle or a wave, it's a wavicle. All right. So if that's not confusing enough, things got worse in the mid-1920s when a fellow named De Broglie hypothesized matter has both wave characteristics as well as particle characteristics. There's a relationship, so-called De Broglie wavelength, where lambda is equal to h over p, where p is the momentum of the particle, whatever it is. And momentum is given by mass times velocity. So where I have a capital H in a circle in pink in the middle of the page, circled by the big red line, is the basic De Broglie wavelength that tells us how the wavelength of matter is related to its momentum. Now this is a bit crazy, but it wasn't really pulled out of thin air. So on the bottom of page 5, I'm going to try to give you some insight as to where the De Broglie relationship came from. If you look where we have the pink A in a circle, you have the fundamental relationship between energy, momentum, and mass, which comes out of special relativity. E is equal to the square root of p squared c squared plus m squared c to the fourth. This isn't a form that you're used to seeing. If we want to imagine this particular relationship and you think of a particle that has a mass m that's sitting at rest, if it's at rest, the momentum is zero. So the p squared c squared term is zero, and the square root of m squared c to the fourth is just mc squared. So in that case where you have a particle at rest that has no momentum, you have the relationship that you're used to seeing, which is E is equal to mc squared. Now, the more general relationship is what I've written here. And if we want to look at a different example, instead of thinking of a particle that has a rest mass, let's think of a photon where the mass is equal to zero. So in this case, E is equal to the square root of p squared c squared, or E is equal to PC. This is the relationship between energy and momentum for a massless particle, or a photon. It may sound a little bit strange to talk about a momentum of a photon, but in fact, they do carry momentum, and this is the basic relationship. And you can actually derive this E is equal to PC relationship using standard Maxwell's equations. So although I'm motivating it using the relativistic relationship, it can come out of classical physics. Now, what comes out of quantum mechanics is at the bottom of the page where I have the pink D in a circle. We know that E is equal to H nu because this is the relationship that Planck and Einstein hypothesized to explain black body radiation and the photoelectric effect. If we combine this with the relationship between the velocity and the frequency, V is equal to lambda nu, where I have the pink circle E, then we can rewrite the frequency in terms of the velocity of light C and nu, where V for light is C, okay? So C is equal to lambda nu. So where I have the circle, the pink F in a circle at the bottom of the page, we have a relationship that comes out of E equals H nu plus the wave picture of light, C is equal to lambda nu. So E is equal to HC over lambda. Now, I can take this equation F and find an expression for E over C, and if we go up to where we have the equation B, I can find a relationship for E over C. So up at the top, I have P is equal to E over C. At the bottom, I have H over lambda is equal to E over C. And if I set these two things equal to each other, because they're both equal to E over C, I have lambda is equal to H over P. So where I have the circular G, the G in a pink circle, lambda is equal to H over P for a photon. And there's nothing really novel about this. This is relativity plus E is equal to H nu. So this was not de Broglie's big step. This is just a relationship that everyone knew could be true for a photon. Where de Broglie made the big step is he said, well, maybe this particular relationship is actually true for particles with mass. And that's what leads to the expression given by the big H in a pink circle in the middle of the page. The minute you say that lambda over H nu, lambda is equal to H over P works for a particle with mass, then that's sort of the big conceptual jump that de Broglie made. And now things get a little bit weird. Why do you not notice this? What de Broglie is saying is that any particle with mass actually has a wavelength. So cars have wavelengths, cats have wavelengths, people have wavelengths, and subatomic particles like electrons have wavelengths. And you just, that means you should diffract as you go through doors, you should reflect off of things like a wave. I mean, you should fuzz out. There should be a limit to how well you can actually locate a person, because how do you locate a wave very easily? I mean, you can see a water wave at the ocean, but what does it mean when you try to locate the water wave, right? I mean, how do you get it better than within a few meters? So where is the exact center of that wave? It's a very strange concept to talk about localizing a wave. So this whole idea of having mass with a wavelength is very, very strange. So why is it that you don't need to worry about this if de Broglie is what de Broglie says is true? Let's go to page 6. On page 6, I calculate the wavelength of a baseball, which is being thrown at 92 miles per hour. So that's a reasonable speed for a major league baseball pitcher's fastball, for example. A baseball, a typical mass is about, or I guess an exact mass, is 142 grams. And the 92 miles per hour corresponds to 41 meters per second. So I want to change the units from miles per hour to meters per second so that all the everything, I can use the de Broglie relationship with H in a units that I understand. So the momentum of a baseball is given by its mass times its velocity. So if I take the mass of the baseball in kilograms and multiply it by the velocity in meters per second, I find that the momentum of a baseball is 5.7 kilogram meters per second. I can then plug this into de Broglie's relationship. Lambda is equal to h over p. Now, h is this crazy number, remember, where h is equal to 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. So I divide that by the momentum of 5.7, and what we find is that the wavelength of the baseball is 1 times 10 to the minus 34 meters. 10 to the minus 34 meters is just unimaginably small, okay? 1 micrometer is 10 to the minus 6. A hair is about 100 micrometers in diameter, roughly, 1 to 300 micrometers in diameter. So that, I mean, you're millions and millions and millions of times smaller than that. So this is so small that you can never see it. You can't observe it. So the wavelength of a baseball in everyday life is just irrelevant. The same is true for cars and dogs and people. It's just not something we have to worry about. If you go to page 7, what I'd like to do is to calculate the wavelength of a 1 electron volt electron. 1 electron volt is an energy scale that we commonly use, actually, in everyday life, right? Remember, your batteries typically are a couple of volts, and it's an energy scale that's sort of normal. But let's look at what the wavelength of an electron at that energy scale would be. If the electron has 1 EV, remember that we can convert from EV to joules by this factor, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19. So the 1 EV electron corresponds to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. I can calculate that corresponds to an electron having a velocity of 596 meters per second if I use an expression which is given by where the pink A is in a circle, that the basic kinetic energy of a particle is equal to 1/2 mv squared. I don't know that we've really used much of that, but it doesn't matter. If I know what the energy of a massive particle is, I can determine its velocity. And in this particular case, I find it to be almost 600 meters per second. So mass times velocity, the mass of an electron is 9 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms. Multiply it by the 596 meters per second, and I get the momentum to be 5 times 10 to the minus 28 kilogram meters per second. Now I can calculate the wavelength of the electron to be Planck's constant divided by this 5 times 10 to the minus 28. And the number I get is 1.3 times 10 to the minus 6 meters. That's 1.3 microns. Now that's starting to be something on the order of a fraction of a human hair. This is not so incredibly small. In fact, that is big enough that carefully designed experiments can see this type of wavelength. And the moment that you have reached a size where you can observe something on the order of the size of that wavelength, then you should be able to see wave effects. And people see this. You can take electron beams and observe diffraction and interference, just like we've seen with the sound and with laser light. So actually, de Broglie's relationship appears to be true. It's just something that in normal everyday life we don't have to worry about. Remember that we have evolved in a world where objects move at certain speeds and they have large masses, and the wave aspect of them is just irrelevant. So that's why it's so counterintuitive to us to think about something that has waves. It's not something we need to worry about in everyday life. But if we want to explore the universe at very small scales, that's just sort of outside the realm of what we're used to, and we just have to deal with the fact that nature has some surprises for us, and this happens to be one of them. So when things are very small, you have to worry about the wave-like aspect of them. You can do lots of interesting things with this. You know, we've talked about diffraction. Remember, diffraction is this phenomenon with waves that if the light is bouncing off of something that has a size that's on the order of the wavelength of the light, that the light spreads out. You don't get a clean reflection of the light. Or another way we've talked about it is if a wave is moving through a thin opening where the opening is on the order of the size of the wavelength, that the wave spreads out. And the example that we've seen was water waves passing through, passing a big wall in the water where there's a small opening. As the water waves pass through that opening, they look like they emanate from that opening and go out in a spherical sort of way. So this is a well-known wave phenomenon called diffraction, and electrons and light also have it. Now remember that we talked about the fact that optical microscopes have a limit. There's a limit to how small a thing you can image with visible light, and that limit is given by diffraction. You really can't see something which is on the order of the size of the wavelength of the light or smaller. And one way to get around that is to not use light to image something, but instead to use matter waves, to use electron waves, for example. Lambda is equal to h over p means that the wavelength of the electron can become arbitrarily small depending on the momentum of the electron. So I can create an electron beam that has a wavelength that is fairly small, and I can use that to actually image things. So if you've ever heard of an electron microscope or an electron micrograph, it's basically just like an optical picture, in a sense, of some small thing from a microscope, except you're using something to image it where that something has a much smaller wavelength, and that pushes the diffraction limit of the imaging down substantially. So you will see visible microscopy used, or normal light microscopy used down to the 400 to 700 nanometer range, which is basically the wavelength of light. But if you want to go smaller than that, then technologically one of the things you can do is use a beam of electrons and create pictures of things using that. And so that's why when things get really small and they talk about imaging viruses and things like that, usually what you'll see is an electron micrograph. So let's go to page 8. All right, so one of the great things about de Broglie's hypothesis was that it actually went a long way toward helping physicists understand or motivate the most successful theory of the atom up to that point. So I want to back up a few years to about 1913. Remember, de Broglie came out with his hypothesis in about 1924-ish. And about 12 years earlier, a physicist named Niels Bohr had hypothesized a model for the atom, which was very, very successful. But within it, there was sort of an ad hoc assumption that just seemed as if it were more or less pulled out of thin air. And it turns out de Broglie's hypothesis helps motivate that. So let's back up and talk about the model from Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr is a Danish physicist, born in 1885, and in 1912 he came out with a theory of the atom, which led to his receiving the 1922 Nobel Prize in Physics. Now, the Bohr model is actually relatively simple. It has one very big conceptual piece, though, and that is in the Bohr model of the atom, the positive charge has most of the mass, and it is centered at the center of the atom. And the electrons, or the negative charge in the atom, basically circles or orbits the positive piece of the atom. There's a lot to this, and we will come back to where Bohr got the idea for the nuclear model of the atom. He had worked for a time in laboratories in England where people had done experiments that showed that the mass and positive charge in the atom is confined to a very small region of the atom, whereas the negative charge is spread out. So we'll come back to that, but for now let's just take it as a given. Bohr hypothesized a nuclear atom, and by that I mean that the positive charge and most of the mass is at the center, where the electrons orbit. So you can sort of picture it a little bit like I have drawn in the sketch at the bottom of page 8. Let's go to page 9. So the idea of the Bohr model of the atom, you have a positive nucleus, that's where most of the mass is. The electrons orbit in circles, actually. In the Bohr model, the electrons orbit the center in exact circles. And this is fairly reasonable, I mean, it's fairly easy to understand if you try to understand circular motion of a rock on a string or a planet orbiting the sun or whatever. The basic physical relationships are all the same. And I believe in recitation this week, you will be doing problems to help you understand how circular motion works. Okay, and basically, when you look at the pictures in recitation and you look at the relationship, and we talk about centripetal force, which is the force toward the center of the circle for circular motion, all of that, although you might talk about strings and rocks circling around your head, the same is exactly true for the Bohr model. The thing is, the force that's holding the electron as it orbits around the positive nucleus in the Bohr model is the electrostatic force. It's simply the attraction of the positive nucleus for the negative electron. What is very bizarre about the Bohr model, and what was input as in a rather ad hoc way, is that Niels Bohr hypothesized that only circles of very particular radii can exist in an atom. So if you were thinking about this in a sense of a rock or a sling, you know, a rock in a leather pouch that you're circling around your head, you can have that circle have any radius just by pulling on the leather and shortening the string that's holding the rock. In principle, you would think that that would be the case in the atom as well, that there's nothing implicit in, there's nothing in the system that necessarily says the electron could have only particular orbits. Bohr simply hypothesized, let this be the case, and there was a reason for his hypothesis. Let's go to, but it was still rather ad hoc. Let's go to page 10. I'll come back to the reason why, but let me now talk about how de Broglie really motivated this discrete orbit nature of the Bohr model. Where the pink A is in a circle, we have the basic picture. What you have is an electron which is moving along a circle, which means at any given moment its velocity is tangential to the circle. You know, if you freeze that electron, you ask what direction is it moving, it's always going to be moving tangentially to the circle. There's a force on the electron which is always toward the center, and that's the force which in the recitation this week you'll learn is called the centripetal force. Basic circular orbit. So that's the picture of the atom, according to Bohr. I'd like to step away from that for a moment and remind you of something that we've already seen. Where we have the pink B in a circle, I'm reminding you of the demonstration I showed you in class where we take waves moving down a string and reflecting at the other end and coming back up the string. And what we found was that for very particular frequencies of the waves, or the wavelengths of the waves, we could get standing waves, if you remember. So the ability to create a standing wave is one of the fundamental characteristics of waves, and it certainly works for waves on a string. And if you recall, when we had a standing wave working on a string, that's when you get a condition of resonance. That's when that wave basically takes a form that's very stable. But if you try to send a wavelength down that string, which is not one of the ones that will give you the stable standing wave, you get sort of a chaotic mess on the string, and it's not stable, and you don't get much out of it. And recall that we talked about how this relates to music, if I take a string and I hold it fairly tight with a certain tension and the string has a certain mass and I now pluck it, it will resonate at a very particular frequency, and that would correspond to a frequency where I can get these standing waves. And it is at that frequency that the string will vibrate stably. So that's not particularly new. What I'd like to do though now is, if you're trying to imagine, according to de Broglie, that the electron is a wave, well, if the electron is a wave, then all of our intuition about waves and waves on strings needs to hold for the electron as well, which may sound sort of weird, but that's one of the pieces of baggage that comes with de Broglie's relationship. So what I'd like you to try to imagine doing is to take this picture for where we have the pink bee in a circle and bend the string into a circle and imagine the string vibrating around the circle and creating a standing wave. So let's go to page 11 in the notes. Up at the top of page 11, imagine having a circle given by the broken orange circle surrounding the positive center, and imagine a string that, if it were not vibrating, would basically lie on the circle. But if it's vibrating, you basically could form a standing wave that looks something like the black line that we have in picture A. In picture B, I was a little bit more careful. So you might have a stable standing wave vibrating in this circle, which would look something like the picture where the pink bee is in a circle. If I use a different wavelength, for example, then the interference of the wave with itself as it goes around the circle would cause unstable or destructive interference, and you get something weird like C. So you can see where we have the pink C. If you go where I have the pink small d, and imagine that's the start of a vibration, and then it moves around counterclockwise around the circle to where we have the pink E in a circle, you can see that as the wave gets to the point where you have the pink E, it would interfere destructively with where we have D. So this wave really isn't going to propagate around and around and around in some stable sort of way. Whereas if you look where the pink B is in a circle in the middle drawing, that wave, if it's vibrating in that form, basically can vibrate around stably. So although Bohr specified that the only specific orbits could exist, if you look at the de Broglie picture, you can imagine, gosh, if my electron has a very particular momentum, for example, then it's going to have a very particular wavelength. The moment I have a particular wavelength, it's going to only vibrate stably as a standing wave on an orbit with a very particular circle, if you want to think about it. Imagine for a given, if I have an electron that has a certain energy or momentum, you can imagine it having a particular wavelength. So imagine having a straw, a drinking straw, that corresponds to the length of that electron or that electron's wavelength. You can take that drinking straw and you can, in principle, wrap it around something and have the ends touch each other and have it form a circle of that particular length. You could also take a second drinking straw and attach it to the end of the first and have it bent in a circle and join the ends. And now you have a circle with a different radius. And you can do the same thing for different numbers of straws, all of which can close a circle, but now you have different radii in the circle, and all of them would use the same electron with the same wavelength would actually vibrate stably. You would get standing waves. So the idea is, with de Broglie, if you can imagine that electrons of a fixed energy could only exist in very particular orbits, basically you get the idea that Bohr came up with in 1912, which is you can have electrons occupying only very particular circular orbits, Why is this so important? Well, if we go to page 12, I give you at the top of page 12 the basic relationship for circular motion, which is the force toward the center is equal to the mass of the object that's doing the orbiting times its velocity squared divided by the radius. And this basically is the mathematical condition for something that moves in a circle, as you'll discuss in recitation. True for cars, true for the shuttle going around the Earth, it's true for electrons around the center. When Bohr hypothesized that you have quantized orbits, basically it works out that each orbit corresponds to the electron having a discrete energy. So you can imagine now in the middle of page 12 where we have the blue dot with successive circles around it, each of these circles would correspond to an orbit that the electron in the atom could occupy in principle depending on what its energy is. And the only electron that could occupy one of these orbitals would have to have very particular energy, either E1 or E2 or E3 or whatever. In Bohr's picture, quanta of light can be absorbed by an electron, for example, that's in level E1 or it's in an orbit E1. It could absorb a packet of light if that light corresponded to if it could give it exactly the amount of energy to allow it to have E2 or E3. So a quantum of light would go through the atom if it couldn't give it exactly that much energy. Or another way to think about it is, suppose an electron is up in some high energy orbital, so it has some amount of energy E3. Then at the bottom of the picture, we have the electron in the third circle out, it corresponds to having an energy E3. If that electron makes a transition down to the second energy level, which corresponds to an energy of E2, it has to give up a little bit of energy. In fact, it has to give up an exact amount of energy, which is equal to E3 minus E2. And that energy is given off in the form of a quantum of light or a photon. So the reason that this was so very important as a model of the atom is it gave us a way of understanding the so-called discrete nature of atomic spectra. So if we go to page 13, imagine that I gave you a spectrum and you were looking at a white light source, so a typical light source. Then what you see through the spectrum, through the prism, I'm sorry, if I gave you a prism and you're looking at a white light, what do you see? You see the white light bent different colors or bent different amounts. So basically you see a rainbow spectrum of light coming off, you know, ranging from red down to deep blue. And that's what you get from a source of light that is emitting light at all the various frequencies. It turns out, though, if instead of giving you a bright white source of light, that I showed you a particular atomic gas, so I could take a tube of glass and excite just hydrogen gas or just neon gas or something like that, so just a very particular atom. It turns out that if you look at it using a prism or another device which also spreads out the wavelengths of light called a grating, if you looked at the atomic source, you would not see a continuous spectrum of color. Instead, you would see very discrete colors. Only very particular colors of light would come off. That corresponds to very particular energies for the photons that are emitted by that atomic source. Similarly, if I pass white light through a vat of atomic gas of some sort and I look on the other side, I would find that those atoms of light would absorb very particular colors of the light, or very particular photon energies, if you want. So this is what I mean if I say, when I say that atomic spectra are discrete. Atoms don't absorb rainbows of light. They absorb only very particular colors. This was known before Bohr. This was known in the late 1800s. And the Bohr model was the first model that really cleanly explained how this might be the case. Although Bohr, so this was why, by putting in energy levels for the electron that could only exist at very particular places, that would mean that a given atom could only absorb very particular colors of light, those colors that corresponded to the differences between the electron orbitals. This was the great success of the Bohr model. He was able to create a model of the atom that reproduced exactly the colors that were absorbed or emitted by the hydrogen atom, for example. And up until Bohr, nobody could explain the fact that hydrogen atoms absorbed or emitted these very particular colors. And this was a huge success, although people didn't quite understand what the motivation was for the way in which the discrete levels were assigned. That came about with De Broglie. Once one made the hypothesis that the electron was a wave, then you could argue that only particular orbits would be stable within that atom. And in fact, it turns out that the orbits that are stable in the atom are exactly the ones that you need to make the Bohr model work and explain the spectrum of the hydrogen atom. So this was a great advance in our understanding of the atom. The Bohr model, page 14, the Bohr model of the atom is very important because it worked with the quantized nature of light. If you believe in the Bohr model, then the atom absorbs packets of light, not a continuous spectrum of light. It emits packets of light, and this is exactly what you had to have in order to explain the photoelectric effect and blackbody radiation. So this is known as this our first real quantum model of the atom. The Bohr model of the atom explained discrete spectra for simple atoms, particularly one-electron atoms. And truthfully, I use the Bohr model to visualize the atom. It gives much of the intuition that you need to understand the modern atom basically is there in the Bohr model of the atom. So this is more or less the end. I mean, this is the end of what I wanted to cover for today's lecture. Let me give you a little bit of insight as to where we're headed. The moment that you say the electron is a wave, then you have to handle it differently, and the Bohr model is an example. But the Bohr model is basically a classical physics model. You're treating the electron going around the atom in a circle in exactly the same way as you might treat the shuttle going around the Earth or a rock going around your head if you're rotating it on a string. The physics, the centripetal force is equal to mv squared over r, is exactly classical stuff that you would use for any of these other problems. So you're treating that little piece of it actually treats the electron as if it's a rock, I mean as if it's a particle. At the same time, you're only allowing orbits to exist if you could form standing waves. So you're treating the electron a little bit like a wave there. So it's a bit of an inconsistent picture. We call it a semi-classical picture, where you're invoking a little bit of quantum aspects and mixing it in with some classical things. It's not really formally a very clean mathematical theory built on the wave nature of the electron. So the next step in physics was to develop a model of physics that could take the wave nature of the electron as a very fundamental aspect and try to solve for it under very particular circumstances and see what happens. So, for example, if you take a wave electron and you put it in a bit of space where it is attracted by a positive nucleus in three dimensions, and you solve that problem, what happens? The Bohr model is really a planar model. You're actually picturing it in two dimensions, so it's a very imprecise thing. And all the success of the Bohr model really doesn't work the moment that you go to more complex atoms. So to make progress, physicists had to uncover the mathematics of dealing with particles as waves. And this is what we really formally mean when we talk about quantum mechanics. And the mid to late 1920s to early 1930s is the period in history when physicists invented this new mathematics, which is known as quantum mechanics. And before we get into it, you know, I just have to give you a warning. We're now outside of the realm of where your intuition works well. We're talking about particles having wave characteristics, and all of the mathematics deals with that. So you have to think that what's coming out of that may not be exactly what you might expect, or the way in which we're allowed to look at it might be a little bit different from what we're about to expect. In fact, it gets really very strange and a lot of fun. Okay, so that's all I have for you today, and I appreciate you listening in. And I will see you next Wednesday. Goodbye.